This audio file is a production of Chiasmos, the University of Chicago's International and Area Studies Multimedia Outreach Source. For related audio and video, or for more information about the project, please visit chiasmos.uchicago.edu or internationalstudies.uchicago.edu.
One of the last events of Displacement Week. After this event, which is a forum on the relationship between the University of Chicago and the surrounding communities, we will also have an event sponsored by Southside Solidarity Network at 8 o'clock in this room called Saving Grove Park, Successful Community Organizing on Cottage Grove. And tomorrow we have a bus tour of Chicago led by a professor of sociology from DePaul University, and we have just a few slots left, so if you would like to join us, it's at 3 o'clock tomorrow. You can come and talk to myself or Sameet Malik, and we can sign you up. And I'd just like to thank our sponsors for this week, the Human Rights Program, the Committee on Southern Asian Studies, Chicago Studies, Center for Latin American Studies, Southside Solidarity Network, Center for International Studies, Students for Human Rights, and Students Organizing United with Labor. With that, I will pass it off to our moderator for this evening, Wallace Good.
First of all, I'm glad that you all came out tonight. I know that everyone has absolutely packed schedules, so we think that this is going to be provocative. We think this will be an opportunity to hear and have insights that you might not get on a daily basis. Again, I'm Wallace Good, Associate Dean of Students in the University and Director of the University Community Service Center. When asked to moderate, it made a great deal of sense for me to ask students who work within the University Community Service Center what would be the questions that you would want to ask a panel. Actually, I told them they should come tonight and just ask the questions and I wouldn't need to moderate anything. And they said, no, Dean Good, here are some of the questions. So in the course of the evening, the process will be quite simple. Initially, I'll ask each of the panelists to give a 5-minute introduction of who they are and their organization. And then I will pose a series of questions for the first half an hour or so, and then we'll open it up more for questions from the group that may not be covered in the kind of questions that we began with. Okay, so we'll go ahead and start, and I'll start immediately to my right.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. Let's try it again. Good evening. Hi, I'm Susan Campbell, and I'm Associate Vice President in the University's Office of Community and Government Affairs. And I've been with the university for close to, 2 years now. And prior to that, I worked as a partner in an architecture, urban planning, and construction management firm, which engaged in a number of neighborhood development plans around the university. So I worked on many improvement plans for the city, for community organizations. Actually, Maddie was my client at one point. Yep. So I've been able to take that experience and network of contacts and try to help the university improve and move forward our community relations. And I'll just stop at that because I know I'll speak a little bit more about specifically what I do later, right?
Or I would say introduce the office of the intellectual.
Well, I don't know how many of you are aware that there is an Office of Community and Government Affairs. Well, that's not too bad. We have our work cut out for us, I think, to get our word out a little bit more. But specifically, the office is responsible for maintaining positive relations with community organizations, obviously, all around the university, with the city of Chicago, and globally as well. We do that through a number of different initiatives. We have a charter school program, which probably some of you have heard of, one of which is located in Woodlawn. We have two in North Kenwood, Oakland. And there's a third that's coming that's sort of between North Kenwood, Oakland, and Bronzeville, which I can speak with questions later about. We have an employer-assisted housing program and other quality-of-life programs to improve the environment around the university for university faculty, students, and staff so that we can encourage them to come and live around the university. We also work on a number of issues that address specific day-in and day-out life. For example, the co-op grocery store, which is probably our latest claim to fame, or maybe fame. Right, bringing in another grocery store in Hyde Park. Let's see, what else do we do? as the community face for the university, our office is largely the group who people come to first in talking about real estate matters for the university. So we look at whether or not the university might be interested in partnering with organizations or expanding or contracting or selling real estate. All of those type of decisions actually get funneled through our office. So it's sort of a first step before it goes through the system. I'll just leave it at that.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
They're really quiet. This is, I'm used to, you know, talking like I talk on the corner with, you know, the people in my neighborhood, so you all need to act like I'm talking to you on the corner, okay? But my name is Maddie Butler, and I'm the executive director of Woodlawn East Community and Neighbors, who has been in Woodlawn since 1980. We were formed because there was a fire next to my house that burned up 13 kids, an arson set fire. In the early 70s, near to early, late 70s, Woodlawn was going through a series of fires every weekend for about a year. And I think it was the University of Chicago, was it social worker graduate, whose project was to find out why the fires was happening. That's what his paper was on. And he discovered that all of the fires, 90% of the fires were arson set for profit. Hmm. And during that time, I was living in Woodlawn as a young person, probably around your age, and maybe a little bit older. But had my one daughter, and I was living on 65th Place, right off of Stony Island. And these babies burned up in an arson set fire, and I was livid. I mean, I was scared, I was livid, I was crazy. I didn't know what to do, I couldn't sleep at night. I would close my eyes and see those charred bodies coming out of that building. Babies that I had seen come into the world nurtured their families, their mothers, when they were in the sack, and really had, you know, help to deliver them into the community. So I was really a community person, but I was an absent. I wasn't into this community organization stuff. If somebody had told me back there that this is what I'd be doing, sitting up here talking to you, I told them they was a lie, that was not what I had planned to do for my life. But here I am some 28 years later. We do, because of that, we got out into the community. I got out in the community, started knocking on doors, asking my neighbors close to me what the heck is going on, because I couldn't understand it. We was losing buildings were being charred, but the thing that really frightened me is that we were losing people and nobody cared about it. And now we're talking about displacement then. That was horrifying in terms of fires and stuff that was being set. So I have a long history that I can really relate to in terms of how people get displaced in gentrifying communities and where that gentrification starts from and where it ends up at. We started then with doing advocacy work, trying to save buildings, trying to save families. We really went in trying to save families, and what we wound up doing was saving families and buildings. Out of our work came some programs that the city of Chicago adopted and made a citywide program, which was called a Housing Abandonment Prevention Program during the time when Harold Washington was mayor, and it lasted during the first or the second term of our existing mayor. They renamed the program something else, but it still does exist. And it was from the work that we had done in Woodlawn and that we had really spread out across the city and made it work in other communities, or helped it to work in other communities. During that time, a lot of other groups were emerging, and so we got together and started a thing called the Chicago Rehab Network. And we became a developer in our own community. At the time that we were developing, it was not a sophisticated thing to do, and it took us 5 years to do one project, as Mrs. Cameron well would know.
We were the architect.
Yes, they were our architect on the projects that we did. And it took us 5 years to do those projects, and our projects was done to stabilize community residents, and we are providing rental units for homeless and near homeless people. I am a community resident of Woodlawn and have been since 1963. We own a family building at 1526 East 65th Place, and now I own my own home at 1543 around the corner from that building on 65th Street. And during that time, we have done a lot of stuff trying to keep people in our community and trying to, when the community starts to develop, that the community people would develop with it and not without it, not pushing them out, but develop with the community in it. And you can ask me questions later about that.
Thank you, ma'am. My name is Brian Echols. I'm the executive director of MAGIC. MAGIC is a long acronym that stands for Metropolitan Area Group for Igniting Civilization. I have to take a deep breath before I say it, because by the time I get to the end, I have to take a breath. MAGIC was started in 1998 and officially incorporated with our 501c3 in 2001. Our organization was started by 8 University of Chicago SSA grad students, 4 of which who grew up in the Woodlawn neighborhood. And had it not been for WeCan and Maddie Butler, they wouldn't have had a house. Basically, Maddie gave us our first office space and helped us to get started. The organization was originally founded to fill gaps that existed in the Woodlawn community. And what it was, there were no youth programs. So they began to do focus groups in one of Maddie's buildings on 61st Street, 61st and Kenwood. And they asked some of the students, you know, what are you looking for? So of course the boys asked for sports, and the girls were saying, you know, we don't want to play basketball, we want to do something more meaningful. So based on the Y chromosome and, you know, sending out, create a program, who came back first? The girls came back first with a program. The name of the program is called USOC, United Sisters of Civilization, and it was a girls' entrepreneurial program, and it was called the Building Blocks to Womanhood. So it taught them how to start their own businesses, own their own businesses. They would solicit us for funds in the form of proposals. So in a sense, they were becoming empowered. When they wanted to do their first round of programming, they came to us and asked for money for a pizza party and some other things. And we told them that's not really how it works. You have to do a proposal and then go solicit some funds. So they went to the University of Chicago Hospital and asked Michelle Obama. And Michelle gave MAGIC their first donation to our girls program. As I stated, we consider ourselves to be a youth empowerment organization, leadership development. We teach our students civic engagement, civic responsibility, social equity, and to take ownership of their own communities. Right now, there is a percentage of our students that are down at the Audi home right now protesting against the conditions at the Audi home. Are you all familiar with the Audi home? The Audi home is a youth detention center, and the conditions there are
horrible.
Thank you.
Been horrible
for a long time. So some of our youth are down there now working on that. yesterday, some of our youth were involved in protesting against the CPS school closings. MAGIC is a part of many local and national coalitions. We are the fiscal agent for the Black Men and Black Boys Initiative, which focuses on improving the quality of life of Black men and Black boys locally and nationally. We look at the issues that we face and those issues that are oppressive from the standpoint of policy. So we have been coming together locally and nationally for the last 3 years, getting this initiative moving and creating a policy brief. We are also a part of Harry Belafonte's Gathering for Justice, which was created when a young girl in Florida last year, 5 years old, was arrested, handcuffed, and brought before a judge because she was unruly, in her kindergarten class. Your eyes went up. I saw you. Yeah, this is happening. This is happening locally, nationally. There are human rights violations. And basically what we want to do is make sure that we don't do what has happened in the past. We want to make sure that we groom the next level of leadership and that they are well-networked. Another initiative that we are a part of is called the United Congress of Community and Religious Organizations that is part of the Casey Foundation's Equal Voice campaign, which is designed to bring 10,000 families of different racial and ethnic and religious backgrounds together to create 10,000 voices speaking the same thing on a national scale. So I'll stop there.
Before I pose the very first question, let me share with you that I'm a Woodlawn resident. My family has lived in Woodlawn 45 years. I still live in Woodlawn. My mother still lives in Woodlawn. And I grew up with a love-hate relationship with the University of Chicago. That love relationship, as several of you know, I was a kid, 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, and I was tutored by University of Chicago students. I can't tell you what those students tutored me in. I can't tell you if they even helped improve my grades, but I can tell you that they brought me on campus. They took us to Northwestern, DePaul, Loyola. So by the time that I was in the process of selecting a college to attend, I had already been given an incredible view of what college could be. But at the same time, as a high school kid walking down Woodlawn right now in front of where the GSB was, I was stopped by the campus police, and I was asked what I was doing, and I said, I'm walking down the street. And they told me, you don't belong here. Turn around and go back to Woodlawn. And as I proceeded to walk ahead, he said, you don't want me to arrest you. So my father came back down here with me, and thank God we didn't find the officer because my father would have been arrested. But that's the love-hate relationship that many of my peers may have who were blessed with being within the sphere of influence of the university and at the same time address some of those challenges. So when asked to moderate the panel, I was very excited because as I think of where we are now and where we are going, it is an incredible, rare time to be part of the university and part of this community. So the questions will be presented in partially getting a historical perspective from economic development, but secondly, addressing where we are now and what's going on, examples of that. And the part that I think all of us really want to be engaged in is where are we going and how can we influence that direction? So the first question sort of starts with an historic example of, and I'll always start positive and then I'll go to the challenging, successful economic development south of the campus and north of the campus. So can you think of historic examples of successful economic development south of the campus and then north of the campus? And I'll let whoever starts, I'll then just go in the order. So whoever goes, then the person next to them will be next. You don't have to worry about it.
So we each get to define what successful is.
Right, exactly.
Okay, because we probably all have different definitions.
Because I can definitely go north.
Okay, that's right. The part of it. So
right. I can handle the north. No, but tell me, what is successful development?
I'll ask you as the panelists to start. Success is, and then give me an example of it.
Okay, so success is bringing viable businesses to a certain area. Now, when I moved to Hyde Park after undergrad, there were two main streets in Hyde Park when I first came here. There was 53rd Street and 57th Street. And 53rd Street at the time wasn't the greatest. And 57th Street was more vibrant, a little more thriving. And the interesting aspect of it, and as I look at it now, it's almost as if 53rd Street, you want me to start positive? I have to set this up for you. 53rd Street, like I said, it wasn't the greatest, but 57th Street was like, it was a night and day situation. And what I had noticed when I first came to Hyde Park is most of the students and white people hung out on 57th Street, and most of the black people hung out on 53rd Street.
Interesting. That hasn't changed much.
Exactly. And a lot of my friends that grew up in the neighborhood, they called 53rd Nickel Tray, 5-3. So when the TIFFs began in, I believe, the late 90s, they began to create businesses, bring restaurants, At the time, there was a movie theater, so I noticed the foot traffic changed, the facades of the buildings changed. You know, they beautified it, some trees and, you know, a little mulch here and there, and, you know, everyone seemed to be okay with that because, you know, it really is what's on the outside, right? But that's, I'll start there with a positive.
Okay, good.
All right.
Maddie?
South, I guess. I'll go south with the positive.
Okay.
And I guess one of the positive developments that I really embraced was the helping to bring banks back into Woodlawn, into Woodlawn proper. We didn't have a lot of banks. South Shore was in South Shore, and other banks was, High Park was in High Park, and Citibank was in down further in Avalon, Chatham, and Woodlawn was without a bank. And now we've got, even though they don't own us, we got Chase on Stony Island, and we got Cole Taylor, and then some other banks have moved in. Now, Cole Taylor is getting ready to heave up the Woodlawn branch, and it's going to be owned now by Highland. But we're not losing a bank. We're just, Cole Taylor is just moving out, and a bank is still going to be there. So I would say that that was, for me, was a positive move.
Great.
Now I'm going to put my planner's hat on as an urban planner. So the way I define positive economic development is groundswell of a number of activities that can lead to a thriving neighborhood 10, 20 years down the road. Because development is a dynamic activity, which is often sometimes counter-cyclical to the economy, sometimes not, depending on your location. But if it's done successfully, then people who live in the community at the beginning of plans to redevelop it are often still there at the end of its build-out, if they choose to be. And that often occurs more in communities where land is not a restricted commodity, where there's ample land opportunity, because there's ample opportunity for people to come in and construct new housing at different market rates without displacing others in order to live in that neighborhood. So when I define success north and south of the campus, I look at the success that we are now seeing in North Kenwood, Oakland, which some people may define as not successful because they feel the market prices are so high that in turn some people now cannot afford to live there. But I see it as successful because I see a number of community organizations emerge through a process where they worked through a plan to reach certain points of consensus, to develop parts of that neighborhood, to identify other features of the neighborhood that were missing that are now there, such as improved schools, such as parks. And now they're working on the last component, which is to bring back a commercial environment there, because first you had to bring a population there in order for other components to begin to develop. When I look south of the neighborhood of the campus, I speak of Woodlawn south of the campus, I see also positive things going on in terms of economic development, but it's at a slower pace, and it's I see it more in the planning stages. But when I see that is occurring differently now than, say, 10 years ago, is I see a number of organizations which 10 years ago were each doing their own thing independently and sometimes disagreeing over limited resources. I see them now trying to work together toward a concerted end. And so I think that's super positive, because when you get people working together, even though they have different interests, you're usually able to leverage that and get a lot more attention, a lot more resources in an area more quickly. So I think that is a positive thing that is occurring now. Even though it's not anything visible that we can yet see, it's something that's necessary. It's a foundation that has to get laid in order for things to be successful.
Before I go into the negatives, do you see any continued economic development in the organizations or in, when I think of schools or the YMCA or places like that, the organizational development that continues to bring a stability or quality of life to the area, either south or north?
On our NCP process, we've got something called NCP.
Tell them what NCP is.
Okay, Neighborhood Community Planning Process through LISC, which was funded by the MacArthur Foundation. Tons and tons of money to do this with 18 communities in the city of Chicago. Woodlawn is one of the 18s. Washington Park is one of the 18. and Inglewood is one of the 18. And so we have sister,
in North Kenwood.
We have sister organizations around us where we all have to come together and sit at a table and talk about what we want, how we want our neighborhood to look, how we want to stay here, the ones of us who are talking about longevity, and what, how we will embrace the new people who are coming, because they are in fact coming. And remember, this area now is really earmarked for the Olympic Village, right. And so we're right in the smack dab in the middle of that whole push and pull syndrome that's going on around that. But prior to that, Woodline was in a push and pull internally, because there was organizations like myself who were saying we need more affordable housing because we got 80,000 people out there who are homeless, and other groups saying, no, we don't need no more poor people in Woodline because we got enough. And what we need to do is have upscale folks come in here now so that we can level it off. And so they started deliberately pushing the thing to get upscale housing into Woodlawn, and was successful in doing that. However, the market, they forgot about how do you control this market splurge when they do that. And the market has taken over with condominium conversions. That's caused us to have displacement of rental properties.
Yeah, and speculators.
And so now we're sitting at the table trying to figure out, okay, how do we, knowing that the market is here, how do we interface with that market? And how do we stop them from running over our plans of being a viable community of our choice rather than of their making?
As we move into the challenges or some of the negative aspects of economic development, let's continue on that for a moment. Historically, and again, then I really want to get down to what's going on right now, but historically, have you seen examples of economic development, economic expansion anywhere around the campus that has really resulted in negative realities, negative impact within the communities?
Well, one of the things that I tend to think of, and it really is an extension of your story, and because I deal with a student population that lives right in the community, has grown up right in the community, they have these perceptions. And right out of my office window, there's a construction going up at 61st and Ellis. 61st and Ellis. Mm-hmm. It's going to be, I guess, the new freshman dorm house.
Residence hall.
And mm-hmm. some commercial space. When I watch some of the students walk by, you know, they at first as it was going up, they, you know, you could see them stop and, you know, have conversations. And then finally, one day I went down after school and I was like, so what do you all think of this? They were like, you know, yeah, it's nice, but it's not for us. So, you know, we're not going to come across 61st Street. So, I mean, really, what do we care? We're not going to be here long. So when I look at that development right there, it's almost, and it could be that there is a wall that has been created within the community. And one of the things that I shared with them is like, you know, this could be a place where you live in the future. If you handle yourself and make the right plans to get to a university like this, this is a possibility. So I told them not to look at it more as a wall, but more so as a bridge. And when they thought of it, it's like, okay, yeah, maybe you're right. But right now, I don't think so. Mm-hmm. So at least I got them to think ahead. So that's one of the things that I see where there's already some thoughts happening.
Well, I was going to talk about that same zone, the 61st Street line, if you will, that really was created historically as a result of the university's urban renewal efforts during the 50s to gain land in order to accommodate future growth, and consequently engaged in a contract
I don't think it's in writing, but it's a contract. Is it in writing?
Yeah, it's in writing.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Who has a copy? Do you know?
Probably TWO.
Oh, okay. Anyway, there's a contract or an agreement where the university agreed with the community not to proceed south of 61st Street in terms of building any academic, buildings or acquiring any land. I think that's a negative. And the reason I think that's a negative is when you go around the country and you look at neighborhoods that abut universities, the ones that are truly successful are the ones where you can't define a seam. They're the ones where you don't really know if you're on campus or if you're off campus because the seam is penetrable. Can't speak tonight. Anyway, you know what I mean. You know, the 61st Street agreement, I think, in turn, actually ended up backfiring in terms of helping the neighborhood. Mm-hmm. Because I think from the neighborhood's perspective, they were thinking they were preserving their turf for their own purposes and future growth. But if you look at what's there between 61st and 63rd, well, particularly 63rd, mm-hmm. you have a vast open area with no development for anyone and no improvements for anyone. And so I don't think that that was a success. And I think, you know, thinking through maybe, you know, both sides could have thought how to change that. Thinking through how to change it now, I think, too.
Last chance on the historic perspective. Any other examples of failed economic development strategies? And I think those three are clearly good examples. I think they're, and they're historic. Before we move into some things that are going on right now. And Brian, you hit on some things right now, but I want to go more into now. But any other historic pieces that would be relevant?
Let me kind of piggyback on what I've just heard and say that historically, in terms of that 61st Street with the University of Chicago, at the point that that was developed, there were 90,000 people in Woodlawn. It was a sea of folk. Mostly African American and Hispanic, and some mixed couples, you know, white married, intermarrying, blacks and whatever. I mean, it was a pretty well laid out community. But because the South Side was a side where people from the South, Mississippi, was migrating, they would come in on the train. Mm-hmm. And this was the first stop. Mm-hmm. And so they would get off the train here, and that's how we got, Woodlawn got 90,000 people in it, in an area that only had 36,000 units of housing, which is, you know, which a lot of people then took advantage of, the building owners of the of those six flats and 12-unit buildings really took advantage of the fact that migrants of blacks was coming to Chicago, cut up that property and milked it to death, and put more people in one room than should have been in a three-bedroom house. And at the time when that agreement was made with the university, the community was so full of people that we had no place to go. And it was displacing 300 to 600 folks with that move. And so the agreement was that they would build Grove Park and replace the people who lost their places along 60th and 61st Street to the university in Grove Park. And that's how we got Grove Park. So just a little bit more history about that.
Let's fast forward a little bit. Let's look at current economic development that is going on. And again, all sides of the campus. Let's be cognizant that, again, in the future, we have been earmarked for a place that the Olympics is likely to come. So what's going on now in terms of economic development that, first of all, is positive? I always start with the positive. But I also want to go, what's going on now in terms of economic development that is questionable as well? So let's first start with the positive economic development on the peripheral of the campus.
Well, the university and the Woodlawn NCP group, which you just heard Maddie talk about, are working together on a market study of Woodlawn, actually, because we want to identify what is the potential for being able to attract commercial development to Woodlawn. In other words, this study is a little bit different from most market studies that look at the demographics, because we understand we have challenges there in trying to attract retailers if we just look at the demographics. So this market study's focus is really looking at the leakage, or the dollars that are leaving the neighborhood as a result of not having anyone there, any businesses there for people to spend their money on. So we're working together on that, because this is something that we hear about from our students, faculty, and staff who reside in Woodlawn as an amenity that is missing in the neighborhood. And I think that's something positive.
On a positive, I'll go a little bit further north. Mm-hmm. I'll go in, I guess that's considered Kenwood, 43rd, right? Little Black Pearl is a definite positive. In the community, so much of a positive that has been duplicated in the Hyde Park, what is it called, Art Center? I mean, you know. Anyways, so that is a true positive, because that is a space that is, you know, it has a cafe in it.
Tell them where it is.
It's 47th and Greenwood. Mm-hmm. That facility we use for meetings. We've used the facility for national meetings, poetry events, dance events. The students there learn how to create, market, and sell their products within the gallery.
They're
t-shirts.
Actually designing all the streetscape improvement elements for Cottage Grove also, and they receive such acclaim that the city wants to use them in other neighborhoods to design banners and murals and other types of things.
Mm-hmm. Right across the street from Little Black Pearl is... they're doing construction on the Muntu Dance Theater, but it's hit some snags. I don't know where it is right now. But when it finishes, that'll be a positive aspect.
Muntu is an African dance company, international, nationally leading African dance company.
Mm-hmm. And then I would also say, me being a resident of Hyde Park, is just the expansion of Hyde Park produce. Mm-hmm. Anytime you can get fresh fruit, you know, you can't beat that. So that's personal. So there's my positives.
Okay, good.
Negatives?
Nope, not yet.
All right.
Set the tone for what's going
right.
on, and then
right.
what are our challenges? Maddie?
Well, you know, I'm all stuck in the mud, you know, okay? So when I have to, well, and I weigh the negative with the positives of me hasn't, they haven't shown up yet for me in terms of realness. I mean, I can see them happening if the players do the right thing and act the right way, but for me, I have not seen it yet. All I've seen so far is displacement of population, mm-hmm. which is what I said would happen during this whole surge of regentrification with the market taking over and all that stuff. And we're not finished yet with that. And so I'm going to wait for the negative and talk about that.
What can you tell me about the expansion of the DuSable Museum, the incorporation of Harris Park as a new facility within the area? Are those considered positive economic developments?
Well, yeah. They're positive, but I don't know if they're economically positive as much as they are socially or mm-hmm. service mm-hmm. positive. Mm-hmm. Economic, my picture of economic is where people get jobs mm-hmm. and produce income and get their levels raised by those jobs, or create businesses where they can thrive and develop and then stay in the community. That for me is economic.
Have there been any new jobs created in communities that are adjacent to the campus?
A few.
Not on a mass scale.
Not on a mass scale yet.
So have there been any job training opportunities generated that ultimately are a step removed, which will lead to increased mm-hmm. economic viability for residents in the mm-hmm. communities adjacent?
Well, the university actually has a new career pathway, a new program called mm-hmm. Career Pathways, where we identified mostly 200 entry-level jobs with the medical center, but also with Aramark, who was one of our second-tier contractors,
for entry-level positions for people solely from the community. So this is a new program. It's in its first,
couple of months,
mm-hmm. Yeah. It was actually officially launched at the end of the summer. So we're looking mm-hmm. forward to seeing how that works.
We're using it a lot.
Okay.
But nothing has come out of it yet. I did think of some other positives.
What?
There's a shopping center. Well, so as far as bringing some money into the community, there's a shopping center at 47th and Lake Park. Actually, two. So you have, you know, the Foot Lockers. You have some small. There's spaces for some mom and pop shops, like some cleaners, and there's a Walgreens and Citibank. Probably employs fairly locally. Where else? Yeah, there's the 47th Street, and then across the street is the GameStop and the cleaners, and again. On a small scale, but there are some folks being employed. The Potbellies in, 50, on Lake Park, at 55th and Lake Park.
Okay. But I guess the question.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think though we have to look at this realistically within the context of the city at large, because when you say, are there successes? Yes, there are successes in the form of new types of neighborhood features that make these neighborhoods livable, because there was nothing before other than just housing. And so these are the type of things that will begin to attract people to the neighborhood, and then you'll see other types of businesses come in. But if we're looking for, you know, a U.S. Steel Southworks or whatever type entity that will employ masses of people, I think that's unrealistic. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think we have to look at the university, but also at a network of providers that are across the South Side regionally, as well as downtown, to how we can get our residents in the neighborhoods around us into businesses within that region of networks. Because that's, you know, that really is, that's the reality of what we're facing. I mean, we're not going to find a single employer that will employ a lot of, you know, people
like a bulla.
On the South Side.
Right, on the South Side, no.
So, in fact, when you step back and get a broader perspective of the history, you went back to U.S. Steel, you went back to a time when there were 90,000 residents in Woodlawn. Mm-hmm. One has to contextualize from a day when 63rd Street was a thriving, economically mm-hmm. viable business district.
That's right.
And considered one of the second only to downtown State Street mm-hmm. at one point. Mm-hmm. You know, 55th Street, when you step back, at one time was a thriving economic enterprise. Now, fast forward, we go to a time where Woodlawn went from 90,000 down to, I believe, at one point it was 10,000 people, a loss of 80,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
We think of rock bottom, and then we think of that uphill climb again. Mm-hmm. Let's think of some of the economic development that has not been, or that currently is questionable in the community. I certainly have some questions, but I'd ask you to start with economic development currently underway that is questionable. And the question will be, who is questioning it?
Mm-hmm. Right. The economic development, I guess that's questionable for me, is the whole condo conversion mm-hmm. Economy that started over in our community. And a lot of those now are bellying up because of the housing market. Mm-hmm. And we've got, within 2 days in January, we did like a little, because we were developing a housing resource center, we got our hands and pulled some fingers on all of the stuff that's going on around in housing. And we found that at the end of January, 41 foreclosures happened in Woodlawn, and they were all condominiums. All of the new stuff that was built. That is scary.
Mm-hmm.
That's scary. We are looking at trying to, my colleagues and I who are working at WeCan, and Mr. Pierce Clark, who's sitting right there looking at me, my Housing Resource Center coordinator. We really have a job on our hands in order to try to stabilize what we've got in the community. And that, you know, that is shaking this whole fiber of our community at this point. You know, it's really shaking it up. Some of the stuff that was new that created some jobs, and still on that little strip at 63rd and Cottage, even though people talk about it like it's a bad thing, there are some viable businesses that are there and have been there and have stayed the long haul, you know, and sell good clothes and good products to the community. And that's why they're still there. And then we've had some new people come in and restore the ballroom, that beautiful ballroom that's on Cottage Grove, and that has created some jobs. So that was a positive thing. It's created some jobs in the community. And we've had some smaller little individual businesses along 63rd Street between Stony Island and Dorchester that have moved in and are doing well. They're in on the front end of that whole retail sales. But the plans for 63rd Street will not allow that to move down any further. Right. So it's going to be pockets of retails, small pockets. There might be something at Woodlawn.
At Woodlawn, yeah.
In that building that was salvaged through one of the people who was far-sighted enough to say, okay, we're going to do condos up, but we're going to do commercials on the bottom. That's now sitting kind of dormant because of the market. Right. The bottom has fell out of the market all over the place, not just in Woodlawn, but we're suffering too because we were in that uphill swing. But we're also losing, or can lose, project-based subsidized housing in the next, between 2008 and 2010, we could lose another 2,000 units of that housing. They're coming up for either opting out or the owners selling it to another person who wants to keep affordable housing in place. And once we lose those housing, that's going to mess up our ability to provide housing for low-income people. I mean, it just will, because they won't be able to afford to stay in the housing that's in the community now. The market rate rent is out of control now in our community. I mean, a three-bedroom is $1,200. Okay? I can't even afford three-bedroom.
And that's renting.
That's renting. Right. That's absolutely.
It's $1,200. That's the market. And so if you can't pay the market, you've got to have subsidy in order to live there. And if you lose the subsidy, you're out of there. And so that's why Grove Park had to fight so hard to stay where they're at.
So then the question becomes, not only from a business standpoint, but when you look at the housing market as it relates to economic development, what's currently going on creates some real questions and challenges about the future of Woodlawn.
Absolutely. But I think, you know, Woodlawn, we shouldn't talk about it as if it's an island. I mean, there are other neighborhoods. Washington Park, for example, adjacent to the west, suffers more than Woodlawn from many of the same things that you just talked about, and severe disinvestment. I think regionally, I mean, you have to look at how development has started to push southward from the South Loop. It will happen along the lakefront, and then it will begin to infill over to the Dan Ryan. And you're seeing some of that pressure now playing out in Brownsville and Grand Boulevard, but it still has to continue to move southward, and it just hasn't because the market is stalled.
Has the commercial and retail development in those communities north of the campus started to follow the residential development north of the campus?
Not at the pace that you would anticipate. I mean, if you look at other neighborhoods around the city that enjoyed redevelopment, and I say enjoy redevelopment because I mean an infusion of new housing choices and other types of uses in the neighborhood, they are still struggling to attract commercial uses, institutional uses, even though they have new housing, condominiums, single family, and renovated housing already in place.
So it sounds as though we've created, rewind, it sounds as though there is a situation, as opposed to who created it, which would be the next question, where housing may be in jeopardy, economic development is not following the residential development, and yet it looks as though condo conversions are continuing?
No, I don't see that.
Yeah, it's not really the same pace.
Not at the same pace, but it's still happening.
So, what does that do for, I mean, in the whole topic of displacement, where does that go? Because if housing, if condo conversions, even though not at the same pace, are continuing, if subsidies are about, potentially could run out, and economic development, commercial development is not coming in to support who's moving there.
Who's being displaced?
Well, I guess the question, who, if their condos continuing to be converted and folks are potentially losing subsidies, which will cause them to move out, and commercial development is not coming to the area, let's give a picture of Woodlawn in 2010, 2011.
That's a nightmare.
I disagree. I don't know. I disagree because I don't really see the displacement occurring in Woodlawn that I've seen in other neighborhoods like the Gap, for example. Because I still think you have a lot of vacant land there. You know, there are plans for it, but it's not built yet.
Right.
And, you know, I think there are some opportunities to try to change that equation if there is enough consensus among the entities that are vocal.
See, but here's what you look at. I was going to say there is... The difference, there seems to be no incentive, and you know, through the Chicago Rehab Network, this is something that we constantly struggled with and studied. There is no incentive to build affordable housing.
No, nationally there is not.
So, I mean, here it is, you have all these people. Ms. Butler talks about 90,000 people being here, and as of the 2004 census or 2005, there were 27,000 people living in Woodlawn. Heaven only knows what it is now.
Right, where did they go?
You know, where are they going? You know, they're being sent out to suburban reservations. One thing about living, whether you be poor, rich, whatever, you have your network. You have social networks. People set up informal networks when they live in, say, Ms. Butler's, one of her buildings. If my child comes home at 3 o'clock and I'm not there, can you make sure that you give him a sandwich or something of that nature? If you hear anything next door, call me. Now you send people out, like in the Chicago Reader, there was a story last week that came out that talked about Section 8 voucher holders who are being displaced and moved into areas like South Shore and what that is doing to a stable area like South Shore.
But it's done. It's done already.
Done, doing, going to do, whatever it is, it's happening. Mm-hmm. It was a stable place, and now you have situations where you have to take into consideration gang ties and affiliations, family gang ties and affiliations, housing project affiliations, how we do things. You know, when you put someone who has never been in a neighborhood, always within a project-based housing arrangement, you know, there are some things that they were not socialized to do.
Well, we know we are a product of our environment.
Absolutely.
And that is for sure, for sure. No doubt about that. I think we can all agree about that. So if you're placed in an asphalt jungle, then you're going to, you know, understand how to live in that jungle and survive. I was raised in Cabrini Greens, and so I know what I'm talking about in terms of a jungle. At that time, it wasn't a jungle because it was just newly built. And at that time, they had sense enough to have different kinds of people living in the Cabrini Green residents. Different families. I mean, we had families that were
full of
candlestick makers, janitors, blue collar workers and white collar workers living in one building. And then you had the extremely poor, like myself, whose pop was a garbage man and dropped dead at 47, and now my mom is on SSA, survivor's insurance, which was then about $200 a month for each kid. And Cabrini Greens was, we watched it being built, living in a cold water tenement two blocks away in a basement, and moved into one of the first towers when they got built. And it was heaven to us. You know, it wasn't a jungle. And when HUD decided that that only the poorest of the poor could live in those structures. It took all of the city workers, all of the candlestick makers, all of the people who had incomes, and forced them out of the projects into other areas.
Substandard housing.
Substandard housing to live. And so then we became an asphalt jungle. But before then, we were a thriving, lively community of varying people in that area.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask one more question before I then open it up to the group. We've sort of gotten an understanding of how it was. We're discussing now some of the realities of right now, how it is, with some questions about the future. And that's where I go. Each of you take a moment and discuss an idea, a strategy that may begin to address some of the concerns you yourselves have raised about economic development and economic challenges faced by the community, and then ultimately, how can we, the university, mm-hmm. in fact, be involved and play a role?
Mm-hmm. One of the things, if you don't mind, there has to be an engine that exists to employ people, something that will allow to reinstill some pride in the place where you live, pride in family, pride in your city. A lot of that, it's gone. Woodlawn is one of the areas that will receive a high influx of individuals returning from prison. And if there's nothing, you know, for those individuals, the natural thing is to go back to the block. Because when you're locked up and you're receiving letters, if you're fortunate, you know, there's always an ask, what are you going to do when you get home? What are you going to do for your kids? And you think about it from the standpoint of stress, like, man, you know, I've been locked up a long time and now I got these little ones looking at me and they're hungry. What am I gonna do? And if there is nothing here, we have this university is well endowed. There are different means that could be created. How many uniforms exist here at the University of Chicago, and the hospitals, the police departments, the maintenance men? Who could clean those uniforms?
Well, you have to have a business that would do that.
Then so, let's make the business.
But I don't think it's the university's role to basically employ everyone that's coming back.
I'm not saying everyone. I'm saying if that is an opportunity, look for the opportunity.
Yeah, I think
try to make
thing,
the opportunity.
Right. I was going to say, I think one thing that we can do, though, is because of our size and the fact that we are here, is serve as a catalyst and work with businesses that are here to help mm-hmm. them gain the capacity to either expand, grow, attract additional businesses, so that you begin to see an economy emerge that's a legal economy in the neighborhood, as opposed to an illegal economy that people would tend to gravitate toward because of the lack of something else to do. Mm-hmm. So I think that's something that we as the university can promote, we can engage in, mm-hmm. we can look to, you know, to create programs to do.
That's what I'm saying is leverage the relationship and the power of the university mm-hmm. with the surrounding businesses like it does everywhere else.
Just because I don't think that there's going to be any one industry anywhere on the mm-hmm. south side that can be the only answer for all of that. So,
Maddie, you're coming for something positive,
yeah,
and then I'll open it up.
Okay. In terms of what I think that the universe can do is a couple of things. There is a policy school here that can help to reshape the policy that has caused all of these black men and women to be in jail over some drugs. Mm-hmm. And those mm-hmm. policy people who can set policies and who can really shove that and change the policies that has forced us into a situation where we've got black men and women coming back into the neighborhood who have felonies, who will not be able to get a job, not be able to get a loan, not be able to get federally funded housing, not to be able to go back to school with any federal funds because they have a felony.
Mm-hmm. Or vote.
Yeah,
or vote.
They can't vote. So, you know, we got to change those policies, or we have, in effect, allowed the country to go back to a slavery mentality. to entrench itself back into slavery. Because those people now become slaves to whatever it is that's going to empower them. And drugs right now is what they're slaves to. Mm-hmm. Whether they're selling, and you think that they want to sell it or be on drugs, I don't think so. I don't think so. Mm. But that's one of the things that the university can jump out there on with their policy issues. And they make policies across this world, not just in this city, and not just in this country.
The impact.
But the impact of it goes across the world. Yeah. The other thing that they can do is, you know, we've got some genius minds over here. They get the best of the best.
Right here in this room.
We got some genius people over here who can put those brains together and figure out how we can develop a strategy to bring those people home out of the war that's in Iraq and out of the war that is in the jailhouses and bring them back to the community and be civil citizens. And I don't think that that's an impossible dream or an impossible thing to happen. And I don't think that that's too much to ask of a huge University of Chicago that is nationally and internationally, worldwide known. I really don't. I mean, in terms of the, it's just the small, so it's these small things that become great things because the policies have to be addressed. The social work school is over there, is nothing but a think tank that could really develop those social things to help people. While we're transitioning from the laws that's causing this problem into laws that will stop it from happening, if I make myself clear. And I don't know if I'm doing that.
Let me open it up. Let me find out what your questions are and a rare opportunity to have a panel like this who may be able to address them and rare to have a group of students who may be able to work on them, as our president now says, theory into action rather than exclusively life of the mind. Question. Yes, sir.
Can you talk about how the buildings got knocked down between 61st and 63rd as part of urban renewal? How the L tracks got taken down?
That's a favorite story.
Yeah, that's a good story. Right there. The role of the Southeast Commission. Do you see them as good guys or bad guys?
Southeast Chicago.
I see them as really bad guys.
Let's see why.
Because they took down our L. I mean,
didn't take that down.
Well, who took
that
it down?
That was
right. Well, okay. Well, they was
that's
all
totally
in
different organization.
Okay.
No, you have to be
right.
Clear. It's a okay, totally
clear,
different organization.
Okay.
Buildings between 61st and 63rd, the L and Southeast.
And the
Commission.
L and Southeast.
That was TWO and Apostolic Church.
Right. TWO Apostolic Church. But the university didn't say this is crazy. Chicago and Boston is the only two places in the world where they've taken down mass transit to do development, to create an island
But didn't that occur after the agreement had been signed that the university would stay out of the community's business south of 61st?
Yeah, but you didn't.
Right. No. But I'm saying, the university didn't do anything to stop it.
Right, you didn't do anything.
Right, because we said we were going to stay out of the community's business south of 61st.
But come on now, baby. They were already over in Woodlawn. They had already broke that agreement. They own stuff because they own stuff south of 61st.
No, that's not true. That's not true. The university does not own land. No, that's not factual,
okay.
Maddie.
What about that? Hold on. What about that vacant lot on 65th?
Except for the charter school, we don't even own.
That's
Chicago Public Schools.
And Stony Island that has this big fence around it.
Stony Island.
65th and 65th place in Stony Island that belongs to. You're going to tell me
that
belongs to the University of
Chicago? No, it's not. 65th and Stony Island south of the South Side Y.
Yeah, I know what I'm talking
about. No, that is not. That is not the university's land.
I have been told consistently that we don't own anything south of 61st. I mean, I haven't. And I have to believe that because
Allison
the people
Davis.
Who told it to me.
Alan,
he does 64th and Stony Island.
Okay.
That's Allison Davis'
property. Right, And I think the city owns the lot to the south of that because that's where they want to put the target.
But I guess the question, the buildings between 61st and 63rd, a lot of buildings have been torn down in there.
Why did they took down the L? We fought really hard for that L because we thought that would be a viable, it was part of what made Woodlawn viable, that
Why
we
did
had
take
this
the L down?
Massive concentration of transportation.
But why did they take it down?
Well, I don't know why they took it down.
Well, the way that I understand,
they took it down because they wanted 63rd Street to be a bedroom community.
They perceived, they meaning the Woodlawn Organization and Apostolic Church, perceived the L as a physical barrier that that inhibited the knitting of the community together north and south of 63rd Street.
That's my understanding.
Mm-hmm. And
what happened to the commercial development as a result of that on the street?
Well, actually, well, it was already largely vacant with the L there.
As one who lived on 61st, I mean, as one who lived in Woodlawn during that time, the 63rd Street corridor had become an incredibly challenging place economically with the L there. Mm-hmm. And in fact, many of the businessmen and women that I knew talked about the fact that the L created an environment on 63rd that was not conducive to business. It was a major transportation reality. It connected the north side and downtown to the south side in many ways.
And to the south suburbs.
South suburbs. During that time, nearly every major study that came out, you know, I was there, and nearly every major study that came out recommended against taking that L down.
I'm agreeing.
Recommended against taking that L out for the economic hardship that would put on people trying to get to work.
And
all kinds of
transportation.
And the business, wait a minute, and the businesses that were underneath that L, even though there were some who said, we don't want the L here. There were others who said, if you take it down, we will die. And that's what happened. They had to shut up, board it up, and then they had a plan.
And then the city came
in. The city had a plan once they took the L down. Before they took the L down, let me go back in time. Before they took the L down, they ran out most of those major little small mine power businesses that were thriving that they had foot traffic with. They tore up the sidewalks on both sides of the streets.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
So, I mean, that was deliberate.
So then there's a third question.
That stuff was deliberate.
Southeast Commission. Thoughts on Southeast Commission?
That they weren't even in Woodlawn doing anything other than tracking crime. But this, do you all know who the Southeast Chicago Commission is? Southeast Chicago, some do, some don't. Come on, raise them. Wake up!
You know who they are?
One, okay.
The rest of them are looking at you like, what's
that? I know. I'm wondering, it's like, okay, or do they care, or should I say? Yeah, I should say
they don't know what it is. They're looking blank at you.
Southeast Chicago Commission is a not-for-profit organization. They have an office on 53rd Street. They were formed during the 50s, I understand, as part of the urban renewal efforts to track crime particularly. As it related to blighted neighborhoods, and that's been their primary focus.
And they've still
pretty much remain focused on tracking crime. They have a witness assistance program, housing court. They track housing court violations, etc. They have not been involved with redevelopment. They are not involved with redevelopment. Southeast Chicago Commission.
They provide statistical information.
They have people come and present to the community. They facilitate discussions.
Wait a minute, and they throw their weight behind it. And there's some really weighted people.
It was the University of Chicago that helped form that commission.
In the 50s, or when it started. So that's fact. Allison Davis was involved. They've used statistics to help influence economic development.
Valerie Jarrett is now part of it, right? And Valerie,
former board chair of it,
mm-hmm. and she was also the president of Habitat Corporation.
But as it relates to Woodlawn, though, which I think, are you talking about it as it relates to Woodlawn or just in general?
I'm talking about how the university, with the Southeast Commission and the city of Chicago,
in the 50s,
engaged in a policy of urban renewal. Locally known by many people as New York, to create a kind of isolation of the University of Chicago from what was seen as a threat of a poor black community.
Mm-hmm.
Back in the 1950s, Mike Nichols and Elaine May, when they were doing comedy here, talked about Hyde Park, that then had a reputation as an integrated community, as black and white, shoulder to shoulder, together against the poor.
That's only partially true.
Excuse me?
That's a partially true and partially not. There were many people who worked both with the Hyde Park Community Conference and SCCC to bring people together. Professor Thielen, Herb Thielen, who just recently passed away at the age of 94, get out and speak with people and organize blocks in the Hyde Park area that saved a lot of areas. They wanted to do that for Saul Linsky also. So in Woodlawn, that didn't work out awfully well. Then came the decision to back off from Woodlawn south of 61st.
And virtually every business on 55th Street was destroyed
right.
and removed, except for Woodlawn Path.
Mm-hmm.
Has it not struck you as odd that that's the only place people can go?
Actually, I think the reality is that you're right. It happened back in the 50s, and you will find on a video that we have and produce here that all first-year students see. It's called You Are Here. It traces the history of the university's less than stellar role back in the 50s, back during urban renewal. And again, it says in that video that there were people and leaders at the university who many of us feel did not make the right decision, but as the Southeast Commission head Bob Mason said at the time, Hyde Park was identified at that point as the second most dangerous neighborhood statistically in the city of Chicago, and the university had to figure out what it needed to do. Faculty brought to the president saying, look, you have to do something, or you either move the university or lose the university. Do I agree, or do any of us agree with the decision? That's not the issue anymore. It happened that time.
And
what are we
and
doing
I to add,
now?
And also I wanted to add, the university was not alone in its actions in that regard. Other peer institutions were engaging in the same dialogues and actions. UPenn, for example, did the exact same thing around them in Philadelphia.
Most recently, the University of Illinois.
During the
and it's not
right, and
not
UIC did the exact
it,
same thing, you know, during the 50s as well. So I think you have to look at what was happening in the era at the time. I'm not condoning it, but I'm saying
doing.
You have to look and see what was happening within the era.
And that you're absolutely right. That is what happened. The question now, and I think where you as students and we in the community need to figure out, where are we now, and what are we going to do? What
same
needs
thing.
To happen to move it ahead?
Yes.
Ben.
Same thing as that.
Well, first of all, let me preface this by saying I'm new to Hyde Park. Just moved here a couple months ago, but the thing that struck me now that we're getting into this conversation about safety and security is the size of the university's police force. And I was wondering what the views of that were in the community, and if that, in this conversation about the wall south of 61st that seems to be built by both sides, what role that plays in it, and if that money couldn't be spent in other ways. I know, especially with the recent incident, there was a lot of discussion about what had happened in other similar urban campuses, and I was just wondering what all your thoughts were on that.
I'll take the party. I mean, I'm the university here, so I guess I'll speak to it from the university's perspective. It's a difficult and complex issue, if you will, that we are faced with having to address. On one hand, we live in a community which is much larger than ourselves, and we have to be respectful of that because we are a community member. We are not the community member. We are a community member. So we have to be respectful of that. But on the other hand, we have to also face the fact that we are an institution whose mission is research and education of a student body, and to some extent we have a responsibility to make sure that our students are safe. I mean, what happened at NIU, I mean, we would never want anything like that to happen, for example. People look at your statistics. They look at the neighborhood around you when they select or choose where they're going to come to school or where they're going to come to work or where they're going to come to teach. And so in that regard, we have to be aware of what's going on around us and think about how we can improve our situation so that we do not look, so that people do continue to choose to come here so we can offer the best education. And that in turn also helps the neighborhood. Now, how that plays out, you know, how that is implemented, what approaches we take, I think those are still open for discussion. But it is, I just wanted to lay the table, if you were, or present the table, if you will, that it's a very complex equation that we are in a position of having to balance.
Comments? Further
comments? Let me just try to jump in on that question and that whole thing and say to you that, the thing about the student being killed on this on Ellis and 61st Street was devastating for the college. It was also devastating for the community. But it got a lot of play on television and national and international. But the little kid that got shot walking from Hyde Park High School in front of my business, nobody knew about him. And they didn't care about him. And so, you know, I need to say that that has to be an equal shared thing here. That life is precious if it's poor or if it's on the University of Chicago campus. Thank you very much. And if it's down in Northern Illinois University, that child that went down there and shot up those people was out of his mind. And how could that college stop him from doing that when he was a student there in the first place? They trusted him, right?
Yeah, could walk could have stopped that?
Who could have stopped that? Who could have stopped what happened to the child that was killed from Africa? You know, who could have stopped that? Who could have stopped the child that was that 17-year-old graduate student from Hyde Park who was an honor student being shot to death in front of my door? Who could have stopped that? And so the University of Chicago police and the Chicago police, if they join forces, because the University of Chicago police, we got more university police than we have Chicago police, I'm told.
Yes, in the patrol area.
In the patrol area. And they are joining together now to give the whole community some respect and some coverage.
Brian, would you like to weigh in on this?
And I think that if we stay on top of them as citizens and say, okay, you're police, but you've got a responsibility to all of the citizens to be the same. You can't treat my son, who lives on this side of the street, worse than you treat you, who are the same age, who live on that side of the street. You just can't do that. That ain't gonna be tolerated.
But the attention and the coverage of the graduate students' death, unfortunately, was not anything that the university orchestrated. That was something that was created by the media.
Wait a minute, I didn't say that the university
orchestrated. But what you're saying is you can't treat one student different than another student. It's not anything that the university, the media did that. The university didn't do that. The media is the one that drew attention.
I understand about the media, but yeah. Do you understand why the media took the attention?
Sure.
Because it's the University of Chicago.
Right.
So if the University of Chicago then says, this is our whole neighborhood here, and we want all of our people to be treated in the same fashion, then that kid that got shot in front of my office would say, well, you know, that kid was shot in the University of Chicago area. And the newspaper would have picked it up and took it nationwide. But that's not the reality. That is not the reality.
Right.
You know, I always found it kind of odd, the size of the University of Chicago police force and the its patrolling borders. I remember the first time I was at the bank on 35th and King Drive, and I saw university cars up there, and I'm like...
Which is a real point of need.
Right. Which, you know,
actually, they only go to 39, so they must have been going for coffee or something. I'm afraid, but they only go to 39.
It, you know what? I would accept that comment if it were warm.
But that, our no, patrol but it is. They only go to 39. South to 64.
And that's because that's where our charter school
that's
is.
Right.
They go within the boundaries of the charter schools.
Okay.
Charter school 37.
Yeah, it's at 38th.
So
right, 38th and Cottage Grove.
Grove.
Right.
So, you know, I'd always wondered about that. And then... because we our office is in a university building, sometimes you can hear the security guard, the radio, and there's descriptions of, you know, a few young men walking across the midway. It's always the same deal. Three black young men, blue jeans, white t-shirt, white gym shoes. Like, wow, that's any one of them. And our students... And I claim them because these are our kids. They have to learn to navigate gang territory. They have to learn to navigate CPD territory. And they have to learn to navigate UCPD territory. And often cases, as I've come to understand it, and you can help me on this one if it's true or false, but a lot of the University of Chicago police are... part-time or are
CPD getting overtime. Mm-hmm. So oftentimes it seems like they run
amok. They're not getting overtime. They're off duty.
Okay,
and
off
so this
duty.
This is their second job.
So all right, second right. job. Right. And in that, sometimes they take that CPD mentality. I saw, oddly enough, and just to show you that how racial this thing is not, I was coming down Cottage Grove right at 60th, right on the midway, and I saw like 8 cars stop one car, and I would have bet my life that it was somebody black, 1 o'clock in the morning. It was a white guy who looked just like you. And I was shocked. I was shocked. I couldn't believe it. And I'm like, why would it take that many police to stop one man? Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, it was a big deal. And he's sitting there, like, with this deer in the headlights look like, me? Me? What? So, yeah, I've always had questions about that.
So I guess the question becomes, in addition to the university's police presence.
Military presence. You know,
which was the question residents of Woodlawn asked. What else could the university do? And that's where, again, I always talk about our office. I always talk about charter schools. I always talk about things that are done in Office of Community Government Affairs. Mm-hmm. The university police department is one aspect of how the university is involved in the community. And again, it's important to think of the other ways the university is also involved. We see the police.
And I was going to point out another fact, though, that largely the reason the university police you see in the neighborhood is at the request of the aldermen and many of the community organizations that are there who have requested the university police to be there. So, you know, we have to also add that to consideration that, you know, it's not just,
let me say that we are one of the groups that asked for the University of Chicago Police to be present in Woodlawn. Mm-hmm. But we've also asked for the University of Chicago Police and the Chicago Police to be more respectful and sensitive when they're called. Mm-hmm. Because when they're called in Woodlawn, if they will open you up.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not just Woodlawn.
When they're called,
the Chicago
in my
police,
they will
you know,
open
I think
you
that's
up.
A.
Okay,
well,
we have a couple more questions here, and then back there, and then right here. So, right here first.
Well, we've talked a lot about economic development, and while jobs are absolutely essential to improving the quality of life for Woodlawn residents, I was wondering what you thought, or what role you see cultural programs and educational programs, after school programs, playing in the development of Woodlawn. And I think that's something that the university as a research institution can do a lot in, and is already starting to do a lot in.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I'll start there because we are an organization that focuses on the education of our youth and the cultural aspect of it. We're always looking to find students on campus that have a similar spirit where we're always looking to work with students who bring that same spirit because that's very important. Also students from the university who can understand that they can be teachers and students at the same time because there tends to be or there has been a traditional way in which students have come into the neighborhood and it's been very paternalistic, very I teach you, and it hasn't been in the past, but it seems to be getting better, where some students are coming into the neighborhood and they're trying to learn and understand. So I don't know if that got.
I guess I could chime in and say that what I think maybe the university could do in terms of the educational and the after-school program is to really sit down and brainstorm. Once again, I am just awed by the fact that there are so many brainy folks over here and that we don't get a chance to really utilize those brains in such a way that will help the community that's around it. And I don't know, but I'll challenge people in this room and say, you know, take it as a project and come and see what you can develop in terms of educational policies and plans for our community, and we'll embrace that, you know. Help us to think about how those things could happen. Right now we're looking at the Chicago public school system being dismantled in such a way that it's not going to even allow for a lot of our kids to have education. And I'm looking at maybe down the road 20 years where there's no public education, and we will be in a place again where history repeats itself, with where the poor will be dumb and the rich will be smart.
Alan?
Yeah, I want to start off by saying that I'm a first year, but I've grown up in Chicago my entire life. I'm a proud graduate of Morgan Park High School. What I see from a practical standpoint, and this is from working and talking to a lot of people that are in CPS, and those people are also in surrounding neighborhoods, for a university that is acclaimed throughout the state, nationally and internationally, it is, to a point, disappointing and almost disgusting how they have no idea that the University of Chicago exists, let alone where it is and the reputation of higher level education that comes with being a part of the University of Chicago or the community around. And in terms of growth economically and working with the community and in terms of displacement of people, I think that a great injustice is not necessarily the people around, directly around the community, not understanding or not knowing that this place exists. So my question is, looking in the future for either Chicago Public School students or in particular students in the surrounding communities directly, is there something that the university can do to make students aware that A, the University of Chicago is here and how it offers tons of different courses on this, that, and the other, and B, that going to the University of Chicago, coming from an inner city education or what have you, is not an impossibility in terms of looking at the cost of going to a upper tier, higher level university, and the stigma that I am a CPS student and I don't have the best education, therefore I should not even look at applying towards the University of Chicago.
I was
quick response. This is going to be the last question.
Okay, I was just going to say, I think we have some programs already in place that, albeit need better exposure. Collegiate scholars, for example. Do you have on the collegiate? Somebody
yes.
in here has
yes.
one on. Oh, yeah, okay, right. Collegiate scholars program. Dr. Larry Hawkins has a program. We have a neighborhood school program in addition to the charter schools, where work-study students go out to schools around the university and offer support as teachers' aides, tutoring, etc. But I agree with you that, you know, those are efforts that we do with limited resources, and that we could certainly expand them. And given the size of the university, part of the challenge also, though, is that it's a very decentralized entity. And so there are efforts that are underway in a number of different other areas, the Harris School, the Law School, for example, who are working with schools also, that, you know, I think that we need to try to harness and at least find out what they're doing so that maybe we can better coordinate these services and market them.
I'll give one thing that I know for the university. The university met with all the schools that have international baccalaureate programs in the city, brought all of the directors of those programs to campus, had a full day introducing them to the University of Chicago. So the reality is the university recognizes and has stepped up the game tremendously in reaching out to CPS.
And in addition to everything that's been said, you're the ambassador.
Absolutely.
Right.
Take that ownership on your own. Create an organization here on campus that's main goal and focus is to make the U of C a reality to CPS students.
That's what we're working on now.
It's 7:31. I'm going to entertain one. You're okay?
You can take another question if you want.
Would you, I hear people
you
at
have,
the mall.
You have one last question? Take it, girl.
I guess it's a little less related to economic development, but with the closing of Shoreland and or relocation of a new dorm, right, on 61st, and you talked about that briefly, and with the universities, I've heard that the university has this goal of having 80% of students on camp living on campus in a couple of years, 10 years, 5 years. Do you feel that at least in the area of student living, student housing, that the university is kind of withdrawing that part, at least into kind of a shell or a wall, and reaching out with these other programs, but at least in terms of students, do you feel like there's a consolidation there?
So do you mean because they're closing Shoreland and moving it more towards the campus?
Yeah, and do you feel like there's a shift? Just personally, with the people I talk to, it feels like there's a shift in kind of where students are supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if that was felt in the long.
As someone from the Vice President Dean of Students Office, there is a conscious mentality of creating and helping the university become more of a residential community. In theory, the argument is in higher ed that if you have more than 70% of your students living on campus, you qualify to be designated a residential community. Currently, we don't have that. Our students wonderfully have scattered to wonderful apartments all over the place, all over the community. We'll talk about the economic impact of a university encouraging more students to live on campus and what that does to the housing market for those renters in those apartments within the High Park and other areas.
That they vacate.
But the idea is that the university has switched to focus more on quality of life of students in the last 10 years than it ever has before. It has switched to develop a Vice President Dean of Students division that is interested in life outside of the classroom. UCSC, University Community Service Center, is only 11 years old. It's again addressing life outside of the classroom and quality of life for students. So the residence hall is one more attempt. In fact, there is another residence hall that is being discussed. The idea is that if you provide quality, operative word, quality housing, at many campuses, students choose to continue to live in those junior and senior kind of living environments in a very quality, productive way. I think the university has failed in the past to provide that kind of quality living for upperclassmen. I think the university will be trying to do that more and more to create a residential community. But how does that impact economic development? Think of all those rental units that are going to be vacant in the long run, and the university needs to think about that. What are we going to do if we take 900 students, 1,000 students who live in the neighborhood, move them into a building on campus? What about those empty units? So that's part of the planning. The only thing that I will add is that whenever the opportunity is there for you to play a role, for you to ask these kind of folks questions, this is what it's supposed to be about. This kind of discourse and dialogue needs to occur every day, several times a day, all day long. I think Susan used the term that for me was very critical. As someone who has been in higher education almost 20 years, when we think of the university as a research institution, I think most people, even students that I talk to, don't get it, what that really means as a research institution. We think of college as a place where students are nurtured, cared for, treated. This is a research institution, and you are here to be around those researchers who will impart wisdom and knowledge on as they do their research. There are many of our faculty who are committed teachers who believe that taking complex concepts and breaking them down into bite-sized bits of digestible information is their passion, is their mission as an educator. But there are many who believe we are researching the cutting-edge issues of the world, and we're going to let you eavesdrop as we do that, and we hope you learn as we do that. That is a very different kind of educational process. Someone, Hank Weber, former Vice President of Office of Community Government Affairs, said, our mission is research and teaching, and the other things that we do that work in the community, that work here and there, is because we're in an economic position to be supportive and do those things. But if the recession occurred and everything cut back 2-3-fold, we would still be a research teaching institution. That is our mission, that is our priority, and the other things that we do are part of being good neighbors, good community, and sometimes good educators. It's great to have a panel like this who understand what's going on, who understand how to bring us closer. I think Maddie challenged you the most in the sense of saying, we expect you to go out and do some research, do some policy, and take what you're learning in the classroom and influence the policy, influence what's going on in SSA, influence the law by being in law school, influence economic development in GSB, and help build this as a residential community. Can we give the panel a hand? Yeah.